The United States, Canada, and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, 25 years ago this December. The negotiations that produced NAFTA were based on a simple idea. Reducing trade investment barriers among the three countries would promote their mutual prosperity. The agreement certainly led to a boom in cross-border trade investment. Here is a quick statistic. Overall trade among the United States, Canada, and Mexico grew from roughly $290 billion in 1993 to more than $1.1 trillion in 2016. But NAFTA has always had its detractors, perhaps none more vocal than Donald Trump. He made it one of his top campaign issues, calling NAFTA, quote, the single worst trade deal ever, end quote. He vowed to withdraw the United States from NAFTA if Canada and Mexico refused to renegotiate it. He repeated that promise since becoming president. Here he is late last month at a rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
We will renegotiate NAFTA, and if we don't get a good deal and a fair deal for our country, and I've been saying for a long time, we'll either renegotiate or we'll terminate. I announced the other day we were going to terminate. Everybody said we'll terminate. Two people that I like very much, the President of Mexico, Prime Minister of Canada, they called up. They said, could we negotiate? I said, yes, we can renegotiate. So we'll start a renegotiation, and hopefully it'll be fair for everybody.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox, discuss what he has said he will do, and assess the obstacles and opportunities he could confront. This week, we're talking about NAFTA. I'm delighted to have two special guests with deep expertise in trade policy with me this week to discuss NAFTA. First, I'd like to introduce Ambassador Andres Rosenthal. Andres has had a distinguished career in the Mexican Foreign Service, serving as Deputy Foreign Minister, among other positions. Andres is also the founding president of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations, also known by its acronym, COMEXI. Great to have you here, Andres.
Thanks, Jim.
Our second guest is Dr. Rohinta Medora, the president of the Center for International Governance Innovation, acronym CG. Rohinton is a world-renowned expert on trade policy and international economic relations. Before taking his position at CG, Rohinton was vice president of programs at Canada's International Development Research Center. Rohinton, thanks for joining us.
Jim, thank you for having me.
NAFTA is obviously a big agreement, involved three countries, different issues in each of the bilateral relationships. President Trump has argued that this is a bad deal for the United States. He's been particularly critical of Mexico. So maybe I'll start with you, Andres. The president points to the fact that Mexico runs a $63 billion or thereabouts trade surplus with the United States. President Trump says that's an indicator that the Mexicans aren't playing fair with the United States. The Mexican government has been quite clear that it disagrees. So what's wrong with Mr. Trump's complaint?
Well, Jim, I think Mr. Trump has it all wrong. To begin with, you called NAFTA a simple idea. It was not a simple idea. It was the first time that two highly developed economies got together with a developing economy. And one of the purposes of NAFTA was to lift up the Mexican economy. That was, I think, probably one of the main objectives. And lifting up the Mexican economy involved integrating Mexico into the North American economic scheme with value chains, with exports, and with a whole series of things that would give Mexico economic growth and the ability to move from being a developing economy to being a developed economy. I think that was the objective, and Mr. Trump feels that it was a very bad deal for the U.S. It wasn't a bad deal for the U.S. The U.S. gained an enormous amount of employment. There are 15 million jobs that depend in the U.S. that depend on Canadian and Mexican involvement in NAFTA. And the U.S. increased its exports to Mexico by a great percentage.
I should point out that Mexico is the second largest recipient of U.S. exports, Canada being number one.
That is correct. And so, you know, he calls And that's, I think, part of his rhetoric. He calls it the single worst trade deal. Well, he also called TPP the single worst trade deal, and he called it—
TPP being the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was an agreement that would have involved the United States, Canada, Mexico—
Plus.
—and about eight other countries around the Pacific Rim.
That is correct. And he also called now, as recently, the deal with Korea as the single worst trade deal that's ever been undertaken by the United States. I think the major problem, and I'll put it in a nutshell, is that Mr. Trump, as a businessman, looks at a trade deficit from the perspective of a business. Businesses can't have deficits, otherwise they go bankrupt. So having a deficit in a country or in a series of countries' relationships is not the same as having a deficit in a business. And you can't erase a trade deficit by stopping trade. It's quite the contrary. You stop trade and you will increase the deficit. Why? Because a deficit comes from a country being unable to save more than it spends. And that, in essence, is the U.S. problem. And it's big trade deficit with China, with the EU, and with Japan, all of whom don't have trade arrangements with the United States, indicate clearly that he's wrong.
Ruhandan, I want to ask you about this question about using trade deficits as a measure whether a trade agreement is working well or not. Because I would note that when candidate Trump and then President Trump first spoke about NAFTA and criticized it, again, most of the focus was on Mexico, that sort of leg of the triad. But certainly upon becoming president, the Trump administration has talked a little bit more about what it sees as the inequities of treatment by Canada of American exports. So could you sort of walk us through this? Because Canada has an $11 billion or thereabouts trade surplus with the United States. And Mr. Trump has sort of, again, indicated that he wants to use this as a scorecard, much like in a baseball game, to measure who's winning and losing.
As Andres said, that metric of trade surplus or deficit bilaterally is actually meaningless. What matters is overall multilaterally, are we all better off with freer trade? There's no such thing as free trade quite yet. Are we all better off with the arrangements we now have, or are we not? And number one, trade deficits are a function of other factors, such as, in fact, savings and investment imbalances. Second, of productivity. It may be that a country has a trade deficit because simply it isn't productive enough. And then the question becomes, are you going to be more productive by closing your borders? And the evidence of countries that become insular becoming more productive is actually really weak. It's usually the other way around, that it's competition and larger markets that bring you the benefits of trade. So I do think the metrics are weak. The final point I'd make is that this is a kind of logic that works individually, but not in total. If everyone took a trade deficit as a metric of the world not working, we wouldn't have a global governance system at all.
Okay, let's talk about then this issue of renegotiating NAFTA, because apparently we're headed in that direction. And I will note that initially the White House a couple weeks ago indicated that it was going to tear up NAFTA or file its notification was going to leave. And then after a series of phone calls, the decision was made. It was announced that the three capitals were going to look at renegotiation. And I guess I was struck that when the talk of renegotiation was first put on the table, that leaders in both Mexico and Canada said, happy to renegotiate. We have issues. We're willing to renegotiate. Let's have those conversations. So we're going to get these renegotiations. So Andres, what is the government of Mexico hoping to get out of a renegotiation of NAFTA?
I think we have a clear situation of a trade agreement that is now 25 years old, as you mentioned, Jim. It didn't take into account certain things that exist today that didn't exist back then. And there were certain restrictions that both Canada and Mexico had to include things in NAFTA that at the end were not included. In the case of Mexico, for example, energy. We had a constitutional impairment to talk about energy outside of the Mexican
system. It was
one
of the big developments of the Peña Nieto presidency was a change to the Constitution.
That is correct. And then there were issues that just didn't exist at the time, like e-commerce, for example, which needs to be looked at as a regulatory issue, among other things. So we were very happy, and the Trudeau government also said, yes, we're willing to sit down and negotiate. Now, what would we like? We're happy with NAFTA. To be honest with you, I think Mexico would be perfectly willing to keep NAFTA the way it is and maybe add on some secondary agreements the way we did with the environment and with labor back 25 years ago on issues like e-commerce, intellectual property. We could even pick up from TPP those areas that we all three agreed on during the negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So could this potentially be a very quick negotiation? Because there are lots of ingredients in TPP. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump, first day in office, nixed U.S. involvement in TPP. But a lot of work has been done on these areas you mentioned, particularly digital arrangements in the trading world.
Years and years of negotiation. I mean, this whole process took almost 7 years to get going. It could be quick. But then again, we don't know exactly what it is that the Trump administration wants to change. They've talked about rules of origin. They'd like greater regional integration, that is, greater regional content of the things that move between and among the three countries. They've talked about changing issues on dispute settlement, which they don't like.
These are the procedure which, if there are disagreements among the countries about the way they're policies proceed, they're adjudicated in a professional, hopefully quick way.
Exactly.
Not necessarily
always quick. I think that's one of the issues we would think merited being looked again at so that we could make them more efficient when there are disputes. But we really don't know yet exactly what it is that the U.S. is going to put on the table. You mentioned the process. 15th of May, apparently, there will be the Senate confirmation of the new USTR.
Robert Lighthizer.
And shortly thereafter, there will be a formal notification by the executive branch to the legislative branch, to Congress, detailing the issues that they would like to put on the table. And it will be then that we'll have an idea of what the U.S. really wants. Mexico is happy to add on these new ideas and new issues, which were not included in the original NAFTA, and to make it more efficient.
Well, what about you, Hinton? Looking at Canada's position, what would Canada want in any renegotiated NAFTA?
So again, we don't know, at least there's no publicly available information on exactly what the details might be. But as in the case of the U.S. and Mexico, I can speculate, and I'd say there's four areas of modernization and four fresh areas that we might want to think about, precisely because, as you mentioned, this agreement needs refreshing. We've had 23-ish years of experience with it. In not necessarily order of importance, but I'd say rules of origin. We now know how they work. It's a tedious process.
Can you actually walk us through this? Because Andres mentioned it, but I'm not sure I'm necessarily all that clear about what rules of origins are and why they matter so much.
So rules of origin matter because at the end of the day, NAFTA is not a customs union. It doesn't have a common external tariff. So it really matters where a product is produced. And if something says it originates from Mexico and therefore can come in tariff-free into Canada, well, then Canadians and Americans want to be assured that that good was produced in Mexico and is not produced somewhere else and seeping into this low-tariff zone via
Mexico.
Okay,
so as an example, there might be a fear that China could export something and sort of use Mexico, let's say, as a way station to get into the American or Canadian markets that it couldn't do directly.
Exactly. And to prove that, it can take up to 100 pages of paperwork for often small amounts. So what's happening is there are many companies that are simply not paying, benefiting from that process, and rather they'd pay a tariff, which is the penalty tariff, as it were, to equalize. So that's one area where we can streamline things, and a number of proposals, including by CG, have been made to do that. Second, on agriculture, sanitary, and phytosanitary standards. Again, this is one of those success areas, by the way. You mentioned trade going up. overall in the agricultural sector, trade has gone up even more than the numbers you cited overall.
And American farmers have been big winners. I certainly know American corn farmers, having lived in the great state of Iowa, very happy to sell corn to Mexico. Mexicans turned to be a big buyer under NAFTA.
$2.5 billion worth last year.
And there's a series of streamlining and domestic adjustments that we could revisit if we wanted to. Third, government procurement, where, again, there's a range of things we could do. And here, keep in mind that Canada, in addition to TPP, has also entered into an agreement with Europe called CETA. So we have two recent examples where we've made advances on how we treat all of these subjects. And simply bringing that discussion into the NAFTA discussion might do it. And fourth, I'd say intellectual property. So those are the old issues that we can revisit. By the way, TPP is really far-reaching on IP, Chapter 17. There's
IP
quite some
being intellectual property.
Right,
which is big, particularly in issues related to software, movies,
and that brings us to the big one. As Andres mentioned, e-commerce and the whole digital economy side simply didn't exist. E-commerce, the phrase, didn't exist in 1994, barely. I'd say border adjustment taxes might come up. If Trump wants to talk about border adjustment for labor, well, we could talk about border adjustment taxes for carbon as well. And the principle is a sound and solid one, which is that you don't dump social ills by pricing things lower than otherwise they would, and you equalize that at the border. Two others, regulatory cooperation. There's a ton of issues where, as a colleague of mine said, the tyranny of small differences is what's causing a ton of paperwork, which we could now, with 23 years of hindsight, revisit. And last and not least, at least for Canada, softwood lumber has been outside the NAFTA protocol, litigated forever, and it would be good if we use the NAFTA table to get some resolution on it.
Perhaps, Rohinton, you could give us a very quick primer on softwood lumber. For the simple reason, a couple weeks ago, the United States announced it was going to impose tariffs on about 20% on imports of Canadian softwood lumber, the argument being that the government of Canada is improperly subsidizing these materials that are used particularly in housing construction. And my sense is this does not make a lot of people in Ottawa very happy. And this is a story that has been going on for quite some time.
And the story is fundamentally that in most Canadian provinces, forest land is crown land. It's publicly owned. The government owns it and then charges something called a stumpage fee to developers who then harvest the lumber and sell it. And the argument is that the stumpage fee that is charged is actually, in some senses, a below-market fee and a hidden subsidy. Canada disputes that at many levels, and also argues that even though in the U.S. you don't have crown land, there are other kinds of subsidies that play in. And at the end of the day, it's a bit of a wash, and one shouldn't make a big deal about it.
So this gets us in the question of regulatory differences, and if you could harmonize those, you could eliminate a lot of disputes, get rid of a fair amount of regulatory burden, which would be good for companies either who are exporters who might want to export, because again, if you can make it easier to export, it's more likely that people are going to export.
And I can give you, Jim, an additional example from the Mexico side, and that is we have current disputes with the United States on tuna and on sugar. The tuna issue is as long-standing as the softwood lumber one is for Canada, because for many years, the environmental lobby in the United States pushed the U.S. Congress to legislate what they call dolphin-safe tuna imports. Mexico hasn't killed a dolphin in its tuna fishery for years, yet it has been impossible to change that law, and therefore tuna exports from Mexico to the United States have been prohibited. Now, after a long proceeding of dispute settlement within the World Trade Organization, because this was also outside of NAFTA, because it came from before, the WTO has ruled against the United States, and now Mexico is either able to sell tuna to the United States or Mexico can retaliate with a certain quantity, monetary quantity of tariffs on exports of the United States. The other one is sugar. We've had a long-standing issue on sugar. Why? Because the U.S. farm lobby and the sugar lobby particularly has insisted consistently on quotas for sugar imports. It's a small industry in the United States controlled by a very small number of companies.
But in a couple of critical states.
In very critical states. And what has happened—
Louisiana, think Florida.
Louisiana, Florida. And by the way, by the Cuban-American, a Cuban-American community. What has happened is that when NAFTA was signed, Mexico was exempted from the sugar quotas. And so what happened was that we began to export larger and larger amounts of sugar to the United States. And the U.S. sugar industry decided to fight back. And we finally ended up in a suspension agreement between Mexico and the United States, where Mexico sugar exports to the U.S., although not subject to a quota, were voluntarily restrained by the Mexican side. That now is under litigation between the two countries. And June 5th has been put as a limit. If the Mexican and U.S. negotiators don't reach an agreement on how to proceed with that, the U.S. is going to impose countervailing and anti-dumping duties, which will add an enormous amount of cost to Mexican sugar producers to enter the U.S. So there, I think both Canada and Mexico have bilateral issues with the U.S., but many of those could be solved in a NAFTA renegotiation.
Okay, so there's obviously a lot of things that could be on the agenda, very detailed, long-standing effect, very real interests, livelihoods in all three countries, which is one of the reasons why this is can be so difficult to resolve. I want to ask the two of you on the question to Mr. Trump's negotiating style. If I understand what the White House has said publicly, that is, they're going to pursue this renegotiation, but if it does not believe that Canada and Mexico are forthcoming with good terms, the president reserves the right simply to file paperwork saying NAFTA is over. Does Mexico City take that threat seriously? And what happens if that in fact happens?
Well, we take it seriously because, as you might remember, just a couple of weeks ago, President Trump was within inches of declaring the U.S.'s withdrawal from NAFTA. Whether he was doing it as a negotiating tactic or whether he really felt that he was going to make good on the threat, I don't know. But the fact is that we will be happy to renegotiate the things in NAFTA that we believe need renegotiation. What we're not willing to do from the Mexican side, and I suspect Canada as well, is to change the basic premise. The basic premise is that we have a very integrated North American economy in which value chains have been created over 25 years that are
So you have companies that make products, but the parts of those products could be made in Canada, could be made in Mexico, United States.
And they can cross the border.
The average car part apparently crosses borders 12 times before it ends up in your Buick.
Yes. Okay. So when you're talking about General Motors, you're talking about Ford, you're talking about Chrysler, these are companies that have factories all across North America, and they've sort of allocated things to maximize efficiency, to lower prices.
Which is what makes the U.S. productive. And then again, coming back to what Rohinton said, this has made North America and the North American automotive industry extremely competitive. They do in Canada the things that are better done in Canada, the U.S. better done in the U.S. and in Mexico. Those value chains are so established that to pull them apart by either putting tariffs or punishing one or the other of the countries or doing any of the things that Mr. Trump has announced against the BMW or Ford because they put a factory in Mexico right, rather than putting it in the U.S. Is counterintuitive and damages U.S. competitiveness at the end of the day.
But let's assume for a second that we do get to that point. And if the president were simply to file the paperwork and sort of negate NAFTA, what then happens? Where do we go from there?
Well, in our case, it's quite simple. If the U.S. pulls out of NAFTA, there is a clause in NAFTA that says that Canada and Mexico continue to be bound by the agreement unless one or both of us pull out as well. as far as the U.S. is concerned, in the case of Mexico, as a developing economy, we are then bound by World Trade Organization most favored nation treatment, which basically means that Mexico can export to the United States under tariffs established by the WTO, which on average are between 2.5% and 3%. So not an enormous difference.
Still fairly open for Mexican exporters.
For U.S. exports to Mexico, especially in the agricultural sector, tariffs can be as high as 37%.
Okay, so if you're a corn or soybean farmer in Iowa, Illinois, in the Corn Belt, this is very bad news for you.
Terrible. It's terrible news, and it's why the Secretary of Agriculture went running to Mr. Trump the day he announced that he might be withdrawing from NAFTA and showed him a map of how many jobs in those states that voted for Mr. Trump in the Electoral College were going to be lost because of withdrawal from NAFTA. So my feeling is that at the end of the day, reason will prevail, and the people who know what the consequences of pulling out of NAFTA are will prevail, and therefore we'll continue to have NAFTA. But if we don't, Mexico would go ahead with its trading relationships. We have free trade agreements with 45 countries, and we have alternative sources of supply. So if the U.S. can't export corn or wheat to Mexico, we'll get it from
Canada.
My
impression is our friends in Brazil and Argentina are more than happy to talk to Mexicans.
Not only are they happy, they've invited all the Mexican consumers, buyers to come. And Canada as well. We've had some discussions about buying wheat from Canada because for us it's equally good.
So being smaller doesn't mean powerless in this conversation.
Well, we can't have it both ways. We can't on the one hand say NAFTA is really good, let's not tinker with it, but also say, but you know what, if NAFTA's over, life will go on. It will, but it's clearly a second best. So I'd say two or three things. One, Andres is right. Canada and Mexico are free to trade on NAFTA terms between them. Number two, in principle, Canada can fall back on the Canada-U.S. agreement, which, although outdated in some ways, provides a basis. The second basis we have, as any member of the WTO has, is it. But I'd also make the point that Andres made in reverse, in the sense that we always say that one reason free trade doesn't prevail is because there are entrenched groups that will suffer from it, and they kind of like the protection, and they will rise up, and that's what. Now we're in the reverse situation, where you've got groups in the U.S. who have understood the benefits of NAFTA, and so rescinding NAFTA would lead them to rise up and create a quite formidable domestic lobby for NAFTA, and that's what we saw 2 weeks ago in agriculture.
And I think we're seeing that in public opinion polling data, where support for trade in the United States has, over the last several months, started to go up as people realize that they have something in stake as well.
Especially because you have a president that's promised to create jobs, not to destroy them. So 15 million jobs depend on NAFTA.
Certainly, I can't finish this conversation without sort of talking about the broader political dynamics here, because these negotiations or renegotiations are clearly going to be carried out by very well-trained diplomats who know these issues inside and out, but they're not doing it in a vacuum. There's a broader political context in each case, and I think it's different in the case of each bilateral relationship, perhaps more fraught in the case of Mexico, because this is also tied to the issue of President Trump's demands for building a wall and having Mexico pay for it. I think there's a potential to really complicate relations between Washington and Ottawa as well. But maybe we could sort of talk about it, Andres, if you could sort of just give us a sense of how sort of the broader Trump presidency is being seen from Mexico. What are the sort of risks we face politically with the Trump administration's policy, because as anyone knows, that domestic politics can get caught up in nationalist sentiment. You can tap into anti-American sentiment. And I just want to get a sense of how you see all of this playing out.
You're absolutely right, Jim. Trump began his Mexico bashing exercise almost from the first day that he announced his candidacy, with the wall, with migration, with drugs, with a whole series of things. He called us rapists. He called us criminals, undesirables. Now, 25 years of building a collaborative, cooperative relationship with the United States changed a lot of how Mexico and the United States interacted. Historically, we always had tension in the relationships. There was the historical issue of the Mexican-American War, the loss of territory. Children in schools were educated to be anti-American to a certain extent. And all of that has gradually disappeared. But in one stroke, Mr. Trump basically ended that. And what you have today is a race to see who is more anti-American in Mexico. We have a presidential election coming up next year in June, so about a year from now. And if we don't solve these issues of the bilateral relationship, and not just the trade issue, which is trilateral, but also the security agenda, migration, border security, all these things, if we don't solve those before campaign begins in Mexico for the new presidential term, we are likely to see a resurgence of anti-Americanism. We're already seeing it. There are calls to boycott McDonald's and Walmart and other things. People are traveling less to the United States. There's a 20% drop in Mexican tourism to the U.S. already because of Mr. Trump's speeches and rhetoric. So, you know, here I hear in Washington often people who say, don't listen to what he says, but look at what he does. In the case of Mexico, it doesn't work that way. What he has said has been so damaging and so insulting to many Mexicans that at the end of the day, I think it's going to be difficult to repair that, even if we reach agreements on NAFTA and other things.
How much does this complicate President Peña Nieto's ability to renegotiate NAFTA if he has to deal with a domestic political context, which is essentially demanding that he stand up to the United States?
It does make it difficult for him. He is already at the end of his administration, close to it. It's a weak government with little popular support. And yes, I think there is that issue that has to be seen, because at least one of the candidates who is already opposing for next year's election has made the anti-Trump, anti-U.S., anti-NAFTA case as his platform for being elected. So it is important that we try, both on the trade issues but also on some of the other issues, to reach agreements before that happens. I think that...
So that's a relatively short timeline, because...
Very short. It's till the end of this year, not much more than that.
What about on the Canadian side? A slightly different political situation. Prime Minister Trudeau, I think, is far more popular than President Peña Nieto is. But obviously, Canada has its own domestic politics.
Different dynamic, but there are some similarities. So first, there isn't a federal election due until late in 2019. So in that sense, there is time. However, there are several provincial elections that will be held, including one this week in British Columbia, where the U.S. issue has already featured. And we have seen the threat floated, and I would think quite strategically, that British Columbian ports might not be used to allow U.S. coal exports to the rest of the world. That is not a coincidence. This is not idle musing. There is a bit of playing to the gallery, and yes, the gallery in Canada is at least as appalled or in some ways questioning of President Trump as in many other parts of the world. So there's provincial dynamics. I don't think that one can take anything for granted. On the other hand, it's safe to say that the room for maneuver for a Canadian prime minister here might be perhaps more than a Mexican leader, but it is not infinite. And at the end of the day, countries enter into trade negotiations not because they learned in economics class that it's a good thing, but because it's good for them in particular.
And I think it's important to point out, Jim, that it has been good overall for all three economies. There is no winning and losing as far as the three countries are concerned. It has benefited, NAFTA has benefited all three. There are within the economies, obviously, sectors that don't benefit immediately or sectors that benefit more. But overall, there's no way that anybody can say that NAFTA has been bad for the United States, as Mr. Trump says. You know, if the credit he gives us for having negotiated better than the U.S. In the case of NAFTA, then how do you explain all of the benefits that have accrued to the U.S. economy thanks to NAFTA?
On that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Andres or Hinton, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock, recording engineer John Fletcher, and with special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Corey Cooper. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.